Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
27th of June, 2023. I'm Miles Maftian, editorial director here at Visegrad Insight. I'm sitting with Adam Yassid, deputy managing editor. Adam, there's so much going on, but obviously, although this was quickly stamped out, we have a rebellion by the one-time ally, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and his Wagner mercenaries. So, look, this obviously reveals the fragility of Putin's hold on power, and it shows again that his decision to launch the war in Ukraine set Russia on a downward spiral. But what happens now? I mean, we've heard some of the developments, we've heard about the exile in Belarus, but I'm kind of obviously wondering what this means for Putin. Some analysts are even expecting this week's events to be the beginning of the end for Putin. So what do you think, Adam? Give me a breakdown here.
Well, the short answer, Miles, is I don't know. I'm sure you're going to be disappointed, but let me try to gather together what we know and what seems to be emerging. First of all, to some degree, this proved to be less of a significant development that many people initially thought when they were looking at it on Sunday. It seems the simplest explanation and one which seems to be most factual is that Prigozhin was basically losing out to the other faction in the Kremlin. The army leadership had convinced Putin to put Wagner and his units under direct military control, ending this duality that we've seen since the beginning of the Ukrainian war. So Prigozhin was defending his turf, his money, his influence. And after failing to negotiate with Putin, he just sort of engaged with that show of force, probably hoping for some accommodation. There is speculation that he wouldn't have moved without some implicit support from some inner, some other influential figures in the Kremlin. But so far we haven't seen that much evidence of this. So he staged this rebellion partly because of his frustration with his personal loss of influence, partly because of the frustration with the way the war is going, and partly because he represents the suspicion of the elite that Putin and the military establishment and the Ministry of Defense represents. And we saw these displays of support for him from Russians during this short mutiny. So at the end of the day, it exposed weaknesses in the whole setup. It confirmed that the military setbacks in Ukraine are serious and causing a lot of frustration and bad morale among the troops. So it's a very confusing picture. And this exile in Belarus is bizarre. You know, if that's the only punishment for treason in Russia these days, then that's really a sign of weakness. But the real question is Mr. Prigozhin there on a mission, or is he in exile?
Exactly. That's kind of the question that I was wondering, because the focus is essentially now on Belarus. I mean, it's also interesting that Lukashenko played a part in ending the rebellion, and he's now playing host, sort of demonstrating his usefulness to Putin. And the opposition used the Wagner mutiny to remind Belarusian military that they should not be directly drawn into the war. But I'm also wondering what this means from the standpoint of Belarus.
We don't know that. And as you know, tomorrow we're going to have a discussion at Visegrad Insight about the scenarios for Belarus. It certainly complicates matters, you know, because on the one hand, you can imagine that it's an exile for Prigozhin and a way for Putin to avoid causing further upheaval by, let's say, putting him in prison in Russia or executing him for treason, which would have probably ruffled many feathers inside Russia, and And remember one thing, I didn't mention it before, but I think it's important. Putin can hardly afford to lose any of the Wagner troops because of his substantial losses in personnel in Ukraine. So at the end of the day, he wants to keep these soldiers and he cannot alienate them. So he probably felt he was forced to accept Prigozhin's, survival. Whether he or whether Lukashenko would allow Prigozhin to establish a serious foothold in Belarus with 8,000 of his fighters, as is mentioned on some by some sources, well, for Lukashenko, that would be rather unwise, given that the same man launched a mutiny in Russia. He could probably do the same in Belarus. So, with a friend like this, you don't need enemies. So we lack clarity. We need to wait and see what happens. But for the moment, it seems that it's a compromise which allowed Putin to neutralize Prigozhin without bloodshed.
Yeah, exactly. I think that this kind of, it's another indicator that Putin is fighting different battles on different fronts. I didn't think that he would be moving to fighting the internal dimension there. So we'll see where that develops. I think another interesting thing that happened was that Ukraine failed to obtain a speedy access to international reconstruction funds at the donors conference in London. I think that there was a sort of absence of any meaningful war insurance schemes. And this is going to be a key obstacle for the private sector, despite having multi-billion dollar pledges from donors, including the EU pledging over 50 billion euros. So I'm wondering, what was the story here? Why the lack of obtaining the speedy access? And what does this mean?
There are two things. It's just terribly hard for anyone to manage to imagine large-scale reconstruction starting while the war is still in progress, and it's difficult for both state and private actors. However, it is important to notice that these commitments are there, and that the private sector seems to be in the starting blocks. So yes, the insurance scheme, a sort of multinational insurance scheme, is missing. It's an important piece of the puzzle. It's not there yet, but eventually it will come. I think what is really important is that both the EU and the United States and other partners have made these pledges going into hundreds of billions of euros or dollars, if you will. And Ukraine is a land of opportunity. There is no doubt about it. And reconstruction, we've seen that in Europe after the Second World War, and we've seen it in other places, that very often post-war reconstruction is really a huge opportunity, both for the host country, but also for investors and partners. So Ukraine has this huge potential. So that's one thing. The other is everybody is still concerned about corruption and transparency in Ukraine. And no doubt Ukraine has made huge progress on these fronts, and there's clearly political commitment to that. The NGOs and the citizens soldiers who are fighting this war, they demand a clean government and transparency and honesty. So there's a lot of pressure for that. But one thing is intentions and pressure, another is ability to deliver after so many decades of a corrupt oligarchic system.
Interestingly, there are some developments in the V4 region, right? Bringing it a little bit more closer to home. President Chaputova announced that she would not seek re-election next year. And this is amplifying political chaos that's already gripping the country and potentially weakening its commitment to support Ukraine. And we had a piece on this, that there were relentless attacks by political foes, and she even had threats against her own family, that this might have contributed to Chaputova's decision not to run in next year's presidential election. So we have this, and obviously we also heard that Kaczynski has returned to government as deputy prime minister. as a sort of a bid to reinvigorate Peace's faltering election campaign and to prop up his protege, Morawiecki. So we have both of these happening, and we have the elections obviously happening within the next few months. Either of these two dimensions, what do you get out of this and the developments for the region?
Right. The important thing to notice probably is that, you know, as the West is more and more focused on Ukraine and the international and European security, and we see the Germans, the French, everybody sort of focusing on Ukraine, Poland and Slovakia are turning inward. Poland is less and less present in some of these formats because Mr. Kaczyński, as you pointed out, is focusing on trying to win a third consecutive term for his Law and Justice Party. Recently, there have been setbacks. Their campaign is lackluster, cannot find traction. Initiatives such as the infamous Lex Tusk, which was an attempt to sort of exclude the main opposition leader Donald Tusk from running through false accusations of being a Russian accomplice of sorts. This has spectacularly backfired. There was international condemnation. There were huge protests in Poland, street protests, and the opposition seems to be gaining in opinion polls as a result. So Mr. Kaczyński is really desperate to find new ways of reinvigorating the campaign. Whether that will produce anything, his return to government, that remains to be seen. In Slovakia, it's a very disappointing, in many ways, it's a disappointing development that President Čaputová decided not to seek re-election and that she made this announcement now before the parliamentary election. Because in a sense, she was seen as a symbol of Slovakia that is attached to democratic values, to European values, and also to supporting Ukraine. And her sort of throwing in the towel, saying that she doesn't know if she has the strength to endure another four-year term, is a victory of sorts for her opponents, populist and very often sort of really nasty campaigners. So, and she's still a popular figure inside Slovakia. So, to be absolutely honest with you, Miles, I'm a little disappointed in her decision, because once you enter politics, you also need to display a bit of a thick skin, and you need to be prepared to fight. And this is what she was communicating only a few months back, that she was not going to give up easily, and then suddenly such a U-turn. That's really disappointing.
We shall see what happens in the next few months. I want to move on to the other part of our podcast this week. We have a great interview with Ivan Lazo-Naj. He's our Marching Crow Fellow. He sat down with Kass Mude. Kass is a renowned political scientist, kind of goes the opposite route here and asks the question of, has populism peaked? So let's go ahead and give a listen to this interview.
Welcome to this new podcast episode. My name is Ivan Lazo-Naj, and I'm a Marching Crow Fellow for Visegrad Insight. And today I have a very special guest in the show, Professor Kass Mude from the University of Georgia, arguably the most influential researcher of far-right and populist politics. Unsurprisingly, that's exactly what we are going to discuss today, with special focus on the Central Eastern European region. Enjoy. Kass, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to finally meet you in person. And we last spoke in 2021. In that interview, you said that the populist hype was over. And ever since then, we have seen that, well, Viktor Orban has won another landslide, Erdogan has won in Turkey, FPÖ are getting stronger in Austria, and there is sort of a renaissance of Trumpism in the US. Would you say this is a new wave, or are they the last one standing from the, let's say, mid-2010s cohort?
If I remember correctly, I said that the populist wave might have peaked. And what I meant by that was not just the electoral success, but their influence on the debate. And I will maintain that. The peak of the populist, and when we talk about the populist, we really just talk about the populist radical right. The peak of their influence was 2015, 16, 17. And particularly because of COVID and because of Ukraine war, the influence of the populist radical right on the agenda, on the political agenda, on what we talk about, like, has been less. Like, the COVID was decided by mainstream parties. Most of the radical right jumped on the anti-COVID and represented a small minority. With regard to Ukraine, the radical right has changed position, have adjusted to the far right, with the exception, of course, with the anti-Russian far right, Poland.
And well, but at the same time, you see clearly Viktor Orban hasn't changed his path. Has it surprised you to see that he didn't take the final opportunity, the invasion of Ukraine, to get off the Russian bandwagon? And he's now still acts as, well, we say in Europe that he is the Trojan horse of the Kremlin. Did this surprise you?
Not necessarily. I think that he has a very strong grip on his party and on the country. But at the same time, as even the most autocratic leaders have power coalitions behind them. And so one of his coalition, which is a complex coalition, some get most of their money from the EU, some get most of their money from Russia. He has to keep both happy, and the interest of a part of, let's say, the Fidesz elite in connections with Russia are just very high. And so I'd expected him to try and balance it. The problem for him is that at this point in time, the overarching issue for the European elite is the position on Russia, Ukraine. And so there is no balancing act possible.
Are you satisfied with the way the West has reacted to the war in Ukraine? And are you satisfied with the support that the West is giving to Ukraine?
Well, I think that that's a bit overly personal. My personal opinion on Ukraine is not that relevant. I think that they have overall taken a pretty strong opinion. Of course, all kind of countries are trying to move around specific policies. They haven't wavered yet. My main problem with it is that for a long time, the market was more important than liberal democracy. Now, increasingly, geopolitics are more important than liberal democracy. You see that very clearly with PIS versus Fidesz, right? I mean, PIS is now increasingly included in the group of, like, the democracies because they're anti-Putin. And Orban is now completely isolated, not just for liberal democracy, but increasingly because of position on Putin.
You mentioned that the populist and the radical far right have failed to control the narratives in the past, let's say, 4 or 5 years. Do you think that their new messaging about wokeism, anti-wokeism and gender are even remotely as salient as their messages about anti-elitism and anti-immigration used to be?
So I think it has power. It has power in the way that Islam and Islamophobia had power, that it bridges groups that don't find each other normally, although over the last decades have. But wokeism, like Islam, will bring together the mainstream right, the Christian right, and the far right, and will allow them to set the tone of the debate, right? And so now you have mainstream right and Christian right that will speak actually in the language and the frames of the far right. And I think that's important. On top of that, wokeism, just like Islam, creates a lot of fears deep within liberalism, centrism. New York Times op-ed page is full of anti-woke articles, as is the so-called liberal The Atlantic in the US. But any newspaper in Britain, the Netherlands, or wherever will have anti-woke stuff. And it even divides part of the gay movement and feminist movement, again, just as Islam did. However, Islam always spoke to the essence of the far right, which is nativism. Wokeism doesn't, or does indirectly. And I think that is the weakness of this strategy. It plays incredibly well to the hardcore base, and particularly to kind of the far right in the media structure, traditional and social media. But on average, if there are economic problems, like, people will not care enough about woke, whereas they do still care enough about Muslims.
Do you think that this anti-woke and anti-Islam and anti-gender agenda is what the Republicans will follow in 2024.
Oh, absolutely.
Or supposing that Ron DeSantis wins, which I believe is less likely at the moment than Trump winning, would he move to the center a bit?
Well, I mean, the center is a non-existent thing these days. But I also think that I can't see the center's win. He lost momentum. But Trump also jumped on the woke train. And what more importantly, at the state level, those states controlled by the Republican Party, which is almost half, all of them are very much passing laws that are against trans, that are against so-called critical race theory. By and large, what they try to control is the narrative that there is no institutional racism, there is no institutional sexism, and that is the key thing. Like we're under threat of the shadowy elite, of the left of Soros here in Europe, of the EU, that tries to pervert our children, because it's very much about the children, right? And then destroy our nation / country. And that's the narrative. But interesting, even in the US, this works only for a small group of the traditional Republican base.
That's what I was about to ask. Is it a platform that you can use on a federal level and a federal elections? Because let's say, like we saw that in 2016, the Republican platform was very strong. In 2020, the Democratic platform was strong enough to convince people, well, we need to vote now to get them out of power forever. But it clearly hasn't happened.
Well, first of all, in 2020, there was no platform for the Republican Party. It was Trump. Should Trump win the primary, it will be the same, right? I think what is important is it doesn't have to work in the same way, because the vast majority of people these days vote negatively. They don't vote for Trump or for the Republican Party. They vote against the Democratic Party. And wokeism means whatever you see negative in the other, right? And so for any type of, for a racist American, wokeism is about race. For a more traditional religious one, it's about secularism. It's about like new gender norms. And so it will be enough, because the vote is not about policies. The vote is about negative. And this woke is just the latest iteration of a long, long line of seeing the Democratic Party as wanting to destroy the American way of life.
Let's come back to Europe for a minute. Do you think that Western European democracies have become resilient to the populist threat?
No, they've mostly just incorporated it. And so like in the vast majority of EU countries, mainstream parties have governed with the radical right at the national or subnational level. In almost every country, the mainstream right in particular, and increasingly also the mainstream left, has adopted not just the issues of the far right, but the frames and therefore the positions. And so as far as if the far right is contained, it is at best contained in the sense that radical right parties don't gain that much anymore. But their narrative, like, is very strong and is beyond debate.
If we look at Europe, and if we look at even transatlantic relations, we see that tolerance towards Viktor Orban has pretty much gone. What do you believe is the more effective way for the West to protect democracy? Is this the American way, that is increasing isolation of an ally who refuses to collaborate on the basic democratic terms? Or is this a forceful rule of law reform, which is, well, let's say the Brussels way? Which one do you think is more effective?
Well, again, the US model is not about liberal democracy. Biden had two summits for democracy at which the Polish government was at which Narendra Modi was. And so it's about geopolitics, and it's not the right way, because what it signals is if you're right on Russia, you can pretty much do what you want in your own country, as it was for a long time in the EU. As long as you voted with the EPP supported you. Like, Orban became problematic when he started to no longer vote with them. I think both are problematic. They're opportunistic. They overestimate the own effect. They underestimate the far right. And the only way is to set very clear boundaries. And the boundaries are not about whether or not you want to have immigrants or whether or not you want to give full rights, or let's say whether gay couples can adopt, right? First and foremost, this is about liberal democracy as a system. And if you go against that, you're unacceptable and you get punished first financially and ultimately, in terms of membership.
When we last spoke, you said that the opposition needs to make the electorate understand that the risk of keeping Orban in power is, well, the risk of losing access to the EU or quitting the EU eventually. Do you believe, just very briefly, do you believe that Hungary leaving the European Union is a possibility in the foreseeable future?
No, I don't. And I think, as has been very clear recently, in the end, there's enough economic interest to keep it Hungary in sight. I mean, you have here the nuclear plant where the Germans pull out, and then like the next day, Macron is here and the French want to play. As long as you have such an opportunistic economic policy, you can't justify kicking out like Hungary, because you also punish, of course, about 50% of the people who don't want to have Orban in power. So for me, this is only really a justifiable position if the EU itself, not just Hungary, lives up to liberal democratic principles.
We see that Hungary as a, let's say, populist or far-right case study is very much dissimilar to the things that we've seen in Europe, and very much the toolkit that has been used to tackle the far-right and the populist right are not really applicable here in Hungary. And we see that despite, or maybe because of the big opposition coalition against Orban, they've suffered their worst ever defeat to Fidesz. Do you think that this regime, with this opposition and with such civic oppression against unrest of any form, against teachers, against students, do you think that this government can be changed, can be toppled in a parliamentary election?
No, not in the short term. In that sense, like, we've just had an even more depressing electoral defeat in Turkey. I think we have to go back to the drawing board. I mean, there were massive mistakes made by the opposition, right? But in the end, what we saw was that with an external crisis, which he didn't fabricate, but he did use, and he used it because he completely controls the media, right? You stand no chance as the opposition. But the question is, what do you do then, right? And so you can't boycott, because then you become invisible. But if you play along as if there are free and fair elections, you legitimize a system that's free and unfair. My belief, and this is, I mean, also fairly desperate, but by and large, I believe that the opposition should keep pushing, because what it will do is that it will make Orban's attempt, and authoritarian regimes will have to become more openly repressive to stay in power. And that might be like visible enough that finally the EU will say, we don't accept these results, right? But as long as it is at this level, right, where we all know that the elections were free and unfair, but it isn't visible.
If PIS falls in Poland, do you think this could be the beginning of the end for the autocrats of the eastern side of Europe? Will PIS fall, actually?
Well, I think that's pretty doubtful, particularly given that Konfederacja is at the moment like the big winner, and they will definitely be interested in a coalition. Janša will come back whether or not Orban or Kaczynski's are in power, right? I mean, there are more than enough other players in that. I think what is important is the narrative might change. Like, at the moment, the narrative about Central and Eastern Europe is as if the whole region is governed by the far right, which of course is nonsense.
But at the same time, Kikkol and Fico could come back. Could come to power.
Yeah, I mean, Kikkol in a very different way. It's not similar levels of power. And I assume Fico comes back, but also he is weak. And in terms of alliances, like they're different. Like there was something special about the PIS-Fidesz alliance that was deeply ideological. There was a personal connection. By and large, Orban sacrificed that relationship for his relationship with Putin. And I think that is the most important development of the last year from a perspective of Hungary. Orban has never been as isolated within the EU and within the world as he is today. And that doesn't help you in the short run, but it must create some kind of opportunity in the medium run.
Ultimately, do you believe that the integration of Central Eastern Europe has been a failure in the sense that no real political union could be created with these countries inside? Has it failed these very ambitious ideas in the beginning that on the eastern side of the Iron Curtain could become just as vibrant democracies and important economic players as the ones on the west?
I don't see it as an east-west. Greece has many of the same problems as East Central Europe. Corruption has always been rampant in Italy, and the liberal democratic system has been highly problematic. Homophobia was major in much of Southern Europe. And so it's not just east and west. A country like Estonia, for example, performs really well. When Janša is not in power, so does Slovenia. Estonia has far less corruption than Italy, for example, right? And so, yes, it went too fast. Yes, we sacrificed liberal democracy for economy, all those kind of things. But we did that already in Western Europe. And so it isn't that Central and Eastern Europe perverted like a well-functioning EU. No, it exacerbated like the problems that already existed in the EU.
Kaz, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.